Hey, ever wanted a t-shirt featuring Bob Roll riding an ostrich? I mean, who hasn't, right? To celebrate the 2019 edition of the Tour de France, Road ID has re-released their Bob Roll-inspired Let's Ride t-shirt that was a cult favorite when it was initially released in 2012. These classy gems are only available in very limited quantities. So if you like Bob or even ostriches, you better hurry over to roadid.com/BOB before they're gone.
Olympic medalist and Tour de France podium finisher coach Bobby Julich and Outskirts visionary Gus Morton invite you to put your socks on. From insightful analysis into our sport's most iconic races and racers to entertaining, educational, and actionable advice, Fizzo is an illuminating deep dive into the art and science of bike racing. Be prepared to put your socks on.
Welcome back to Put Your Socks On. I'm Bobby Julich, and as always, I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Gus Morton. Today, we're talking about Stage 14 of the 2019 Tour de France, from Tarbes to the Col de Tourmalet, 117.5 kilometers. Hey, Gus, happy Colombia National Day.
Bobby, thanks very much. I saw there was quite a few Colombian flags out there in force today. Maybe not a day to celebrate at the Tour de France for the Colombian riders as such, but no doubt a great day to be on the roadside.
That's for sure. And it wouldn't be the Tour if we didn't have a greve or a protest, right? We had one today and it actually forced the race to be postponed for another, plus or minus 6 kilometers than normal from kilometer zero. So yeah, the race was a little bit shorter. Yeah. And then that first climb was a little bit closer to when they actually started. So there you go. Vive la France.
Exactly. I'm surprised. There's been quite a few protests going on in and around France over the last 8 or 9 months. I'm surprised it took this long for it to impact on the race. But, you know, I feel like it's part of the race nowadays and a bit of tradition. Before we get into the show, it's the theme of the day is the difference between being a team leader or general classification rider and a domestique and what those roles entail. It's going to be a great show, Bobby. You've got a lot of experience from both sides of that, both sides of those roles. So we're looking forward to hearing for that. Wanted to say thank you to all the fans thus far. Again, we're at the top of the leaderboard on Tour de France podcast. So thank you very much for that. If you want to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at superfan@velonews.com or reach Bobby or myself on Instagram at bobby.julich and myself at thatisgus. Before we get on, should we hear our daily dose?
All right, it's time for today's daily dose of Road ID Tour Trivia. To play, head on over to roadid.com/TDF. Today's question, and everyone better get this one. At a mere 8 seconds, who owns the smallest margin of victory of any Tour champion? Go to roadid.com/TDF to answer this question and score a chance to win today's daily prize, which is a pair of CD Shot cycling shoes. One lucky winner will even take home a $10,000 BMC shopping spree. Again, that's roadid.com/TDF.
Bobby, what a stage today. Tarbes to the Col de Tourmalet. It was 117.5K. It was on from the gun, and there was no place to hide at all today, was there?
No, not at all. Guys looked nervous at the start today. Combining with that protest, I think there wasn't much talking going on at the start today. They knew they were in for a big one. These short stages have the riders on point and nervous, and that was evident today. The pace was just on from the start. It was pretty cool to see Sagan and Nibali the first to get away, and then they were joined by a much bigger group with 17 guys actually settling in there. But they were kept on a short leash by Dekoninck Quickstep and FTJ, which were, you know, they finished first and second on the stage. So they had a plan, and they executed that plan very, very well. Today we had a 1-cat-4, 1-cat-1, and a horse category. So the first climb was won by Nibali. The second climb, the Col de Salure, that's where things started to heat up. Movistar started a pretty hard tempo about halfway up. Bardet was dropped immediately. nightmare stage for him. Simon Yates and Kwiatkowski were not very good at all. They were dropped in distance 4K from the top. So was Adam Yates. That was a big surprise. Conrad. But luckily those guys had some teammates and they were able to catch back on the descent. The sprint was actually, because it was after the Soulor, the guys that went for the KOM points on the Soulor actually took that sprint. And yeah, Wellens was the winner of the KOM points on top of the Soulor, right in front of Nibali. It looked like Nibali was going to give him a little sprint there, but then thought otherwise. So yeah, going down the valley there, you know, we saw notable attacks. I'd have to say total shout out to a rider from one of the wildcard teams, El Gebert, from the Arkea Samsic team.
He had an incredible ride.
Yeah, that
today.
Team was on it. I mean, they were doing what they could do, especially with Barguet attacking there towards the end. But yeah, once you got on to the Tourmalet, it was a very elite of climbers. It was a very steady pace. And man, I really have to question what Movistar's plan is, because they're up on the front drilling it and Quintana was actually getting dropped. So you got to wonder what the communication there is, as well as the fact that we've heard that maybe he's switching teams next year. But it seems like very often Movistar seems to shoot themselves in the foot with tactics in the Tour de France.
Yeah, that was a big surprise. Like, and it's not the first time I've seen that, a team pulling on the front whilst their leader is in difficulty at the back this Tour de France. But where's the communication there? You know, they rode for a good portion of the stage today. Surely Quintana knew that he wasn't feeling super great and was, you know, maybe told him to pull a log off the fire or something. But nonetheless, that's what happened. He was ridden out the back quite a way to go. And that wasn't the first surprise either of the stage. We saw a lot of guys who suffered yesterday. Richie Port. Well, Richie Port had a good ride yesterday, but Dan Martin, sorry, getting distanced. Richie Port. Few of the big names really started to come apart pretty early on that final climb.
Yeah, it all really started to come apart when Barguil attacked. He was the first guy to go. Went not with a super move, but he definitely upped the pace there. That was what prompted FDJ to take over with David Godu. Young rider, tapping out an amazing rhythm, putting a lot of the big GC hopefuls in the Hurt Locker. Port was dropped at 5K to go. Moss came off. You know, Poles, you know, left very early again, leaving the Ineos co-leaders kind of isolated a little bit too early. But yeah, Goudeau and then Jumbo-Visma. You know, they've had such an amazing tour, and we've talked about their four stage wins, and I question, you know, the support that they would have in the mountains. Did they wait the team selection more towards the sprint finishes? But man, when you have three guys in a select group of what, 11 at that time, man, you're covering all your bases. So what a Tour de France that team is having. But then, yeah, they're towards
they really
the top.
Are.
You know, when De Plus and Bennett took over, put Fuglsang, Oran, Barguil, all kind of off on the back foot with 2K to go. And then Boekman attacked, and it looked like he was going to, you know, maybe have a little bit of leash, but they closed down that pretty quick with Bernal. And then the big surprise for me was Thomas started suffering with about a K to go, wound up losing, what, 36 seconds or whatnot. But, man, it was I have to eat my hat. I have to eat some crow here. I really thought that our boy Alaphilippe would really suffer today, but he's right up there defending that jersey with absolute class. And man, oh man, every day closer to Paris is a day him closer to surprising the world, surprising himself. You know, in the end, it was Pinot, and I'll take a bow because I picked him today. I thought he would have gone a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
When Godeau pulled off, I thought he would just counter right away. But, you know, it was just such a high pace all day long. I don't think anybody had much snap in the leg. You know, when you see a race-winning attack in slow motion like Pinot did, you just know that everyone was on their limit. And at altitude, that's a big thing. You don't have that normal snap. And to go back and talk about those guys that that came off in that last K or two, they had to be really smart, because at that altitude, if you stay on the back of that group and push yourself even 20 or 30 seconds too long and not just go into your survival mode, your pace, you can wind up blowing up and losing a lot more time. So, you know, Garrett definitely suffered today, but at least he limited his losses as much as he could.
Yeah, and you notice that with Uran. Uran let himself, or let the group go, maybe a K earlier than Thomas did, but wound up overtaking Thomas and finishing in front of him. So that's a perfect example, right, where, you know, you got to make sure at that altitude you ride within yourself. What I really loved about today's stage is that, again, it's blown the race open. Thomas isn't quite as strong in the high mountains as, you know, he demonstrated on stage six, and then yesterday again showing that he's not, you know, that he's handling the load pretty well. So that's kind of opening it up. We're seeing Bachmann having a really good ride. We're seeing, you know, Uran still hanging around there. Bargui was good. So, you know, and then of course Kreiswijk, Pinot took some time back today, and obviously Alaphilippe just constantly, you know, everything he does is exceeding everyone's expectations right now. So it's really opened the tour up again, and it's just going to ensure that the next week of racing is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So every day you have to go to war, and there's going to be the winners and losers, but you got to keep fighting on, because the next day it could be you losing time, it could be you gaining time. So absolutely. And the real standout for me, interesting development, is just Kreiswijk, not only, you know, already on the podium, but looking like he's going to be able to protect that place, if not move up. So yeah, great mountain stage of the tour. And yeah, it's kind of hard to pick out that, you know, moment of the stage for me. So I'd have to just give that to the overall pace the whole day long. First by Movistar, yeah, then by Frances Dejou, then by Jumbo Visma. I mean, man, it's going to be impressive to look at the numbers that those guys were putting out for that entire stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, should we hear from the superfan? Seems about that time.
It's time for Superfan.
Hey, Bobby. Hey, Gus. What a stage. The GC guys are starting to really show up. Explain the makeup of a good GC rider to me. You know, we've seen strong time trialists train in the mountains and drop weight to become viable GC threats. And we've also seen great climbers work on their TT abilities in order to evolve into GC contenders. It's got to be much more than that, though. From a coaching standpoint, tell me about the attributes and the lesser known qualities that make up a good GC rider. Thanks, guys. Keep it up.
Superfan.
Well, first and foremost, I'd have to say that a good GC rider, it all starts with that mental ability to stay switched on and focused for the duration of the race. In this case, you know, 21 days. You're not going to be on the front foot all the time, but you have to use your team, be smart, conserve your energy, stay healthy, stay away from crashes. And yeah, you can't miss those splits like some of those guys did. But in the tour, it definitely boils down to the GC guys are the guys that can climb and then can at least defend their position in the time trial. So it's a lot of time, a lot of effort. You know, you're going out and you're reconning these stages before the race. The staff is, you know, paying a lot of attention to you. You're looking at your equipment to make sure that you're not even bringing one extra gram up those big climbs. So more than, you know, getting down to the nuts and bolts of the actual training, I think that that mental ability to focus for that long is what really separates those GC riders, the best GC riders. And for me, another really important thing is your support staff. You know, the communication that you have not only with your teammates, but with the guys in the car. The tactics, you know, the planning, the logistics guy, everything that saves you energy. You know, we're always talking about the guy in the yellow jersey or the guy that wins the stage. He's the one that, you know, gets to celebrate. But there is so much work that goes into all those training camps, all those recon missions, you know, looking out, driving in front of the race to make sure that they are able to feed back information to those guys. And that all makes that GC leader a little bit more comfortable. But you're right, there's definitely different ways of leading a team. My favorite way was with sympathy and empathy rather than, you know, kind of like that iron fist. But, you know, throughout history, mm-hmm. we've seen, you know, different characters emerge as leaders.
And this leads us on nicely, actually, what you were kind of touching on there to today's theme. Or how is the role of a leader different to the helper? Obviously, they're two very different roles, and you've been in both positions, so you can kind of talk on both sides. I guess first thing, and you answered it there, was what makes a good leader? What process is that when you step up? You know, like, can you kind of talk about the first time you really put yourself out there and you're like, okay, I'm the team leader, or you were given that responsibility? Like, how did you kind of find that?
Yeah, I think when you get into the pros, you're automatically a helper. Like, very, very few guys mm-hmm. jump in, even guys, you know, that young Belgian kid.
Remy.
Yes,
Evenepoel.
Exactly. Even him, you know, the potential next Eddie Merckx, has to step in and has to kind of earn their stripes a little bit. The biggest difference, I think, obviously, between a leader and a domestique is the salary. You know, more money, more problems, more money, more stress. And there are certain guys, David Moncoutier, for example, a very good French climber. He was very happy getting paid a normal salary. And one time they came up to him and said, you know, we're going to triple your salary and you're going to be the leader of the team. And he's like, no, I don't want that. I don't want that money. I don't want that pressure. Just pay me what you've been paying me. And I'm going to be either sitting caboose or attacking off the front, winning mountain stages in the Tour and the Vuelta. He was probably the only guy I've ever heard in history that turned down tripling his salary. But yeah, that mental ability to deal with that stress and those expectations is quite intimidating. And he was one of those guys that was wise enough to not take that responsibility and enjoyed his career a lot more. You know, throughout history, you see guys switch teams, get paid a lot more money, and then all of a sudden the grass isn't greener on the other side. And, you know, they got more money, but they got more problems. They're not clicking with the team. They're not clicking with the staff. And yeah, I went from helper to leader, back to helper to leader, back to helper. And you know, it was a crazy up and down career that I had. It's part of that team dynamic. You don't want to say the leader is the highest paid guy on the team, but often that's the case. So I think a good leader is that one who leads by example. He's in the bus. He's not, you know, sitting in the back of the bus. He's sitting in the front of the bus, hanging out with his teammates, really getting them behind him. Mark Cavendish is a great example of that. But leading with a calm and cool demeanor, I think that's super important. You have to show appreciation for those teammates and the staff because, man, they're doing everything for you. And I think that really helps the entire morale of the team. And especially when you come through with the goods at the end of a big objective, there's not a better feeling in the world.
And let's talk about the different types of helpers, moving on to helpers now. Because, you know, it's pretty... I feel like it's doing a bit of a disservice in saying there's leaders and then there's helpers, because there's a big spectrum in each of those, but for argument's sake, but what type of, you know, let's kind of break down the helpers and what are each of these people's roles?
Yeah, I think it's quite a unique situation because there's helpers who are, you know, great riders in their own right. And then you almost have those deluxe helpers, those guys that, you know, Greg Van Avermaet is a perfect example. You know, he's in the classics as a leader, he's Olympic champion, and then in a race like the Tour, if they had a GC hope, you could guarantee he would be up there putting the hammer down in the crosswinds and helping as much as he could get bottles and whatnot. But I think that every rider has to find their niche in the peloton. And yeah, the leaders almost have it easy because they're obviously the best, the most talented. They can change teams and still kind of keep that hierarchy. But there's a lot of guys out there that make a very solid career, 10, 12, 15 years, and we don't even know their names. But the teammates and the staff, the DSs, those guys have made themselves indispensable. And that's the trick, right? You kind of have to find, hey, am I a classics rider? Am I a time trialist? Am I a GC rider or a climber? And if you're not in that podium potential of either of those categories, you have to find your niche. And there's been guys throughout history that have definitely done that.
The examples of these. So we've got the classics helpers, we've got the climbing helpers, hybrid helpers. How is a team sort of built around these helpers? Like, if you're going to the Tour de France and you're Ineos, Like, how many classics helpers are they bringing? How many climbing helpers are they bringing? What sort of hybrid riders? Like, how are you building out a team of helpers, and how many do you need? Like, do you need eight climbers, or do you need a mix?
I think it definitely depends on the race, the parkour, and the objective. So the most important thing for any helper is that they need to be there to make their leader's life a little bit easier. You know, fetching bottles, sitting out in the wind all the time, doing proper pacing on the climbs. That's super important, because sometimes you get these guys that get up there and, you know, new guys that want to impress their leader, and they actually wind up going too hard. So you have to have good communication within the entire team, but those helpers have to listen to the GC guy. And there's often times where the GC guy, you know, has to yell to his helper to slow down. But I think the main thing that makes a helper indispensable is just that relationship that he has with the leader and how he fits in with the other guys. But we do have to remember that in order to get into the pro peloton period, you have to be a very small minority, like, you know, the top 3% of the world's population of cyclists. So these guys are definitely great cyclists in their own right, but, you know, the way their talents are, the team that they're in, or the race that they're doing, that's when they have to kind of slot in there somewhere.
And what's it like asking, you know, being the leader and kind of having the command of your team? Like, what's that pressure like, and what's that situation like, you know, taking on that responsibility and actually being out in the road and being like, okay, this is how we're going to do it. Can you sacrifice your chance for me?
Yeah, when the form is good and the confidence is high, the ambience is off the charts, it's almost easy. It's fun. But the problem is when you are the leader and you're not at the top of your game and you're still asking these guys to do stuff for you every day, that gets difficult. And there's some guys out there that can, you know, pass the torch and, you know, just leave ego out of it and give that responsibility to somebody else. But it's not easy.
No, yeah, exactly right. And that's the thing, right? When you're falling apart, like as we saw, you know, there's some big leaders today were distanced who, well, I mean, Nairo Quintana, like, had his team on the front.
Roman Bardet. Imagine what he's going through right now. And he's going to be leaning on his
team. He had his whole team back there with him today.
Yeah, and he's going to be leaning on his teammates, and they have to keep him motivated. They have to keep his head in the game, because if he loses the plot, you know, they lose everything. Hopefully he can come back and win a stage. And, you know, that's another real, I guess, attribute to a leader is, yeah, these guys are human beings. They're not robots. They're going to have bad days. They're not going to be able to peak on at exactly the right time. But we saw it a little bit with Nibali today, right? He had some bad days, but then he threw caution to the wind and said, hey, I'm going to go out and win this stage. I guarantee he got a lot of respect for his teammates for doing that. And that's what Bardet has to do. He has to rebound. He needs to refocus, reset an objective, and come away with something, because they built this whole year around him. The whole team is built around him. And he needs to show them something. But man, it's hard. When you get knocked down and in the world's biggest race live on TV, you're feeling that pressure. You're feeling that salary that you're getting every month, for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that was a nice mention of Nibali there, because as you said, you know, copped a lot of criticism earlier in the tour for not being, you know, in contention for the win. And he bounced back today and went on the attack, but not only went on the attack, but was smart. He didn't just go on a rampage, you know. When he realized it wasn't going to work out, he just went back to the group, let the group slide by, save the energy, and try again. And I think that's what Bardet needs to do as well, is not just go on the attack for, you know, attacking's sake, but be smart. You know, he's evidently still a classy bike rider and can potentially pick up a stage later on in the tour. So we'll look for that. Who are the best guys you've ridden for?
Yeah, I was pro for 16 years and got to ride with a lot of really, really good guys. I say the one that jumps off the page was Lance back in the Tour de Ponte in 1996. I remember basically being that warm body on the front from day one all the way to the end, and him coming through with the goods and winning. That was a fantastic feeling. Vandenbroek, when he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 1999. That was that was quite an honor. My friend and old neighbor on the Côte d'Azur, Vinokourov, him winning Paris-Nice and Tour de Suisse and all the races that he won, that was one of the guys that you could really, because you were a close friend and neighbor and training partner, you could definitely go deeper for a guy like that. Rode for Basso, for Sastre in the 2004-2005 Tours, in the Giro in 2006. And one of the best parts for me of guys that I got to work for was Jens Vogt, you know, very good friend of mine. And when he won the Tour of Germany, that was so great, because he won the Tour of Germany the year that they finished up on this Austrian mountain pass. I mean, a mega, mega pass. I think it was 2,600 meters up there. And he was in the yellow jersey, and great riders, great climbers. I think Levi was one of them. A couple other guys, Toschnig, they distanced him. And he somehow, when they kind of got to the top, he was able to come back on and actually won the stage, a mountaintop, huge climb.
I remember that.
And him winning that day and him winning his national tour and being a part of that was super special.
Yeah, I actually remember that race. And that's a high caliber list. You've been in the service of some pretty remarkable cyclists and some people who have really changed the sport. What do you do when you got to ride for someone that you don't get along with? It's a job at the end of the day, right?
It's a job. And when the directions come over to the radio or in the team meeting, you just got to do it. But like I said before, I could dig a little bit deeper for guys like Jens than I could for some of the other guys that maybe I didn't have that great relationship with, personal relationship with.
And then going on, like, we hear quite a bit nowadays about there being a lack of respect within the bunch and, you know, kind of no sort of camaraderie or sort of bonding together between teams. Those leaders obviously, you know, respect each other and have a respect between teams. Does that carry over? You know, do certain people in the group have an aura, have like a presence that is respected by the other riders?
You know, you got to remember the team dynamic. You know, it's a family and it kind of is us against them. And in a normal situation, everyone would be buddies. I mean, there was guys that on the bike I didn't like at all. Richard Virenk was one of them. Like, I just, yeah. I didn't get him. But you see him away from the race, especially now, he's actually not that bad of a guy. So you really do listen to the rumors a little bit, and those isolated incidences that you may have with a certain rider during the race is under pressure when everyone's like totally just manning up and ego's involved and you're saying and doing things that you normally wouldn't do. But then you see them at the airport after the race, or you go out on a training ride and you run into them and you say, gosh, you know, this guy's not so bad.
Yeah.
it's quite a, but that respect definitely has to be there within the team. If it's not, that team's morale is never going to be anything worth anything. But you look at De Koninck Quickstep and the way that those guys work for each other. And even when we had Philippe Gilbert, who wasn't selected for the tour, he was very disappointed. He can imagine how happy he is. And that wolf pack mentality that they've created there is breeding success. And, you know, man, if I'm a team out there, imitation is the biggest form of flattery. And I would try to promote that sort of thing. We had very much that same spirit at CSC. And we won a lot of races as well. If you're not getting along with your teammates or respecting each other, you're not going to be successful in this sport.
Last question that I've got for you on the topic. MVP helper in this year's race.
Oh, that's an easy one. I would say Kasper Asgreen. He has been phenomenal. And then to get a top 10 in the time trial yesterday after all the work that he's done. And then a close second is young David Gaudu from Francis Desjeux. Yeah. He was very, very good on Planche de Belfi. He was super today. So yeah, those two guys are definitely standing out as mega MVP helpers of this year's edition of the Tour de France.
Nice one. Should we have a little look at tomorrow's stage and kind of talk about, it's another big mountain day. It's going to be hard, uphill finish. How's it going to play out? And like, what's, you know, what are teams going to be looking to do, basically?
Yeah, you know, you get through one mountain day and then have this one backing it up. You gotta keep going. And with the stage tomorrow from Foix de Prat d'Albi, 185 kilometers, it's longer, much longer than today. So This has been a really hard couple days. They have the rest day coming up on Monday. So, you know, you're going to have to just suck it up and go all in. But yeah, we have one category two, three category ones tomorrow. So, and they come quite at the end of the race. So we have the first category two climb after 60.5. Then we have the sprint at 93.5. And then the climbs come in pretty quick succession, up, down, up, down, up, down. And they're not massive. They're category one. They're not horse category. But, you know, that cumulative fatigue is definitely setting in. And I think we're going to see a little bit different stage than today, tomorrow. I think we're going to see some long, you know, haymakers, some breakaway attempts, some of those guys that lost some time today getting up in the front and trying to make up for it. But yeah, there's blood in the water. When you see the defending champions struggle, you're going to want to put him under pressure. And one thing that we've seen this year, two things stand out. Ineos have not really had to do that much on the front. And luckily for them, because they don't seem to have that same horsepower that they've had in the past. So there's going to be teams taking advantage of the situation. You know, they're going to definitely take on board what happened today, what they saw today. And really start to you know, chip away at the armor a little bit of the guys in front of them. And Geraint Thomas has a big old target on his back, because now they know that he's not as good as he was last year, and it's up to him to take that all on board and really come back and show them that he is defending champion of the Tour de France tomorrow.
And that's it, right? We've seen every single GC guy have one fault in throughout this tour. You know, we've seen one moment where they've presented weakness, whether that was, you know, missing the split or just being found out at one point physically. So there is no, that's what I'm really looking forward to tomorrow, is today showed us that it is wide open, and there's no, you know, aside from Alaphilippe, there's no one guy that's looking like they're under control and they've got it all kind of, you know, sorted out. So with that in mind, who's your pick for tomorrow?
Man, I have a feeling that there's going to be a breakaway up the road, and one of the GC guys that lost some time is going to get in there. So I'm going to go with Richie Port for tomorrow. I think that he needs to take Richie a chance and go for broke, salvage something, because he lost a lot of time today. But, you know, hopefully that was just maybe him going a little bit too hard in the time trial, and he'll rebound tomorrow.
And that's it, right? A lot of tired legs after the time trial. Evidently, everyone had to go deep. I'm going to go with Nibali, I think. I like that your prediction that it suits a breakaway. And I watching him today, he was there. But like I said, when he knew it wasn't going to work, he just sat up and came back. So yeah, I'm going to go with Nibali for tomorrow.
Okay, the question of the day. Will Julian Alaphilippe hold on again on the second consecutive uphill mountain finish to the yellow jersey?
Mate, look, I have to say yes now, because, you know, I backed him today to keep that jersey, but I probably wouldn't have 2 days earlier. And I'm just going to have to go the whole way with him. He's an exciting bike rider. He's a great yellow jersey. I think it's great for the race. And, you know, long live Julian Alaphilippe.
I'm going to agree with you today. Yesterday, I thought that he would lose it, but the way that he climbed today was just very calm. This guy's dangerous. He's not going to lose the GC lead tomorrow.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a hard fight to wrestle that jersey from him. Green jersey, one sprint point. Do you think Sagan's going to go into that break? He's kind of got that wrapped up now, right?
Yeah, we saw him do that today. I don't know if he wants to expend that sort of energy day after day after day, but with the rest day coming up, you never know. But that's the reason why he's soon going to be crowned the seven-time champion of the green jersey, is because he's the only guy that has green jersey aspirations that can make that sort of effort and survive those sort of climbs. Today, he got a little bit unlucky. It looked like he was going to be there. He was there halfway up the Soulure, and then when Wellens went, kind of dropped back. But he still got those ninth place points. So yeah, I think this is Sagan's jersey to lose, and the only way that he's going to lose that is if he has some, you know, unfortunate incident or sickness.
We saw the white jersey switch off Mass back to Bernal today. So I think that'll probably stay the same tomorrow. And then the mountains point, Wellens, is he going to go on the attack again tomorrow, you think?
Oh man, I think if he does, he's got to be pretty careful, because he's definitely been putting out some energy in this first week of the tour as well, you know. But he's got a good lead in that category. But you know, Pinot is getting closer, and points mean prizes, and jerseys are very important to these teams. If you can be on the podium in Paris with one of the four jerseys or the team GC, that's massive, right? And with the climbs Absolutely. That are coming after the rest day, especially later in the final week, a guy like Pinot can just be snatching those up left, right, and center, you know, because he's going to be vying for the win on top of those horse category climbs. So I think Wellens does need a little bit more padding. So yes, I do believe he needs to be in the break tomorrow and just totally profit from the rest day.
Nice. Well, with that, Bobby, I think that about wraps the show up.
All right.
Thank you, everybody, to listening. Thanks for the support. As I said at the beginning of the show, we are killing it in the cycling podcast world. So keep listening, keep spreading the word, keep supporting us. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and SoundCloud. Head on over to velonews.com for all of your Tour de France info, as well as the show as well. And if you want to get in touch, as I said, superfan@velonews.com. Shoot us an email with feedback, questions, whatever you want. Or you can reach out to Bobby at bobby.julik on Instagram, or myself at thatisgus on Instagram. Guys, thank you so much. Bobby, cheers.
Yeah, thanks everyone. And as always, don't forget to put your socks on. We'll be right back.